And that's cultivate our motivation. Begin by reflecting on the great fortune that we have to have encountered the Buddhist teachings. And not just having encountered them, but from our side having receptivity, developing conviction and trust in the teachings and wanting to follow them. So it's a quality in ourself that we should really value and cherish. And in addition, we have the conducive circumstances to be able to study and practice the Dharma and actually transform our minds and hearts. So we should rejoice at our own fortune, at the fortune of everybody here, at the fortune of all beings who have this opportunity. And then form a strong determination to use it wisely. And the best way to use our precious opportunity wisely is to aspire for full Buddhahood so that we can be of the greatest benefit to each and every sentient being. So it's a long-term goal. It'll take us a while to get there. But by really setting that intention strongly in this lifetime, then that can help us stay on the path in future lifetimes without getting distracted. So generate that motivation now. Okay, so we'll start reading page 69. Yeah, so don't feel like you need to read along with me. You can if you want to, if that's helpful. But it can also sometimes be better just to listen. So see what works for you. Okay, so another way to classify consciousness is into non-conceptual and conceptual consciousnesses. Okay, so a non-conceptual consciousness knows its object directly without the medium of a conceptual appearance. Okay, what did I put in the footnote here? Oh, okay. So the term conceptual appearance, you may find in other texts as meaning generality or as mental image. And none of those words exactly describe what it is. It's a conceptual appearance, an appearance to a conceptual mind, a thinking mind, okay? And so a direct, a non-conceptual consciousness knows its object directly without that kind of appearance. So when you look at the gong, you see the black color of the gong directly with your eye consciousness. When I'm speaking, you hear the voice directly with your auditory consciousness. Yeah. When you're eating, you taste food directly with your gustatory consciousness. Same with smells. You know, it's direct perception. You know, the temperature in the room, the feeling of one hand rubbing the other, those are all non-conceptual. So, okay, so our five senses are non-conceptual. You experience the object directly. Yeah? Okay, then. Okay, so sense consciousnesses are always non-conceptual. They are direct perceivers, whereas mental consciousnesses may be either conceptual or non-conceptual. Examples of non-conceptual mental consciousnesses are clairvoyance or yogic direct perceiver of emptiness. Okay. The examples of conceptual mental consciousnesses are when we remember what we saw yesterday, we remember a sound, when we think about what we're going to do or we plan something, when we visualize, all of that is conceptual consciousness. Okay, so, you know, you can see that conceptual and non-conceptual, they're quite different. You know, to be able to see something directly with a sense consciousness, whereas when you're thinking or remembering, there's a conceptual appearance that's appearing to your mind. You're not seeing the actual object at that time. Okay, so if you think of your bedroom, right now, you're not perceiving your bedroom directly. You're not seeing the colors and shapes and so on directly. It's a memory consciousness. That's a conceptual consciousness. So what is actually appearing to your mind is a conceptual appearance of the object, but you're not directly perceiving the object. Okay? Is that making some sense? Now, there are certain non-conceptual mental consciousnesses. For example, when you have deep states of samadhi and you have different super knowledges and different powers to, let's say, see something far away, hear something far away, and so on. But these are special powers developed through samadhi. Okay, so then, so we have conceptual and non-conceptual minds. Now, we also talk about reliable minds, okay, reliable cognizers. This was earlier in chapter 2 of the book. So reliable cognizers are ones that can give us information that is accurate, okay? They aren't erroneous. If you, go out at night and you do like your eye like this, you can make yourself see two moons. Yeah, so that's not a reliable consciousness because there aren't two moons. Yeah. If you think and you think, oh, there's a soul, there's a permanent soul that is really me, that is an erroneous conceptual consciousness. Okay, because there's no such thing as a permanent soul. Okay? So here, a reliable sense consciousness, okay, so one that's going to give us accurate information, correctly and directly, reliable sense consciousnesses, plural, correctly and directly perceive their object. They see color and shape with the eyes, hear sounds with our ears, okay, smell odors, taste, different flavors, feel different tactile sensations, okay? So those we have directly. Based on these direct perceivers, we then think about and remember objects. So these are conceptual consciousnesses, thinking and remembering. What often happens, what usually happens is we have a sense direct perceiver and then we go into a conceptual consciousness about it. But we don't always see the difference between those two. Yeah. And so we're looking at something and then we just automatically start thinking about it, not seeing that there's a real difference in how we're cognizing the object. Yeah. And not recognizing that once we start thinking about things and a conceptual appearance is coming to our mind, we're not getting at the actual object that exists there at that moment. Yeah. Well, it'll be explained as we go into the chapter, but what we're doing is we're taking different information about the object at different times and putting it together as an image in our mind. Okay? So think of the room where you sleep. Yeah? Is that the image in your mind exactly how the room exists at this very moment? It's not, is it? It's a general picture of what the room looks like. Yeah? Think of your mother. Doesn't matter whether she's still alive or not. Okay? You have an image appear in your mind. Is that image your mother? Is that image exactly how your mother looks at this very moment? But you can think about your mother, you know, and learn things about her by thinking about her. Okay? The sense consciousnesses don't think about anything. You just get the information that is there right at this moment. Okay? So based on these direct perceivers, the sense consciousnesses, we then think about and remember objects. So these are conceptual consciousnesses. Thought is conceptual. It does not know its object clearly, but only via a conceptual appearance of the object appearing to your mind. Okay, that's the only way thought knows objects. Is through this conceptual appearance. So Dharmakirti, he's a 7th century great Indian logician, Buddhist. He said, whatever so consciousness has clear appearance is asserted to be non-conceptual. So in the collective topics, the dura, so some of us have been studying that, yeah, a conceptual appearance of a pot is defined as that factor of superimposition that is the appearance to the conceptual cognizer of a pot as a pot, it's appearing as a pot, despite its not being a pot. Okay, so think of a pot right now. Yeah. The pot you're thinking of, is it a pot? No. I didn't phrase that properly. What is appearing to your mind when you think of a pot? Is that appearance a pot? No. Okay. Yeah, you're having the appearance of the conceptual consciousness, the conceptual appearance, okay? So a direct perceiver sees the building, conceptual consciousnesses plan its construction. Yeah? So the appearance of the object to a conceptual mind, the appearance of the pot, okay, or I should say, continue reading here. The appearing object of this conceptual consciousness is the conceptual appearance of the pot, not the actual pot. Okay? So there's two technical terms we're going to come up with here. Yeah, in addition to conceptual and non-conceptual mind. Appearing object and apprehending object. So the appearing object is the object that's appearing to your mind. The apprehended object, also translated as object of the mode of apprehension. But who wants to say that long phrase every time? The apprehended object is the object that you're either seeing or thinking about. Okay, so when you have a direct perceiver, the appearing object, let's say, is the color, shape, or the sound. But the appearing object, when you remember what you saw, is a conceptual appearance of the color and shape, or a conceptual appearance of the sound. Okay? It's not the actual color and shape, not the actual sound. Okay, you with me so far? Yeah, kind of, a little bit. A conceptual appearance is a representation of the object. It is the appearing object of a conceptual consciousness. It is not the actual object, but it allows us to think about various qualities and aspects of the object. Okay, so a non-conceptual mind doesn't give us that ability to think about the qualities and aspects of the object, to compare the object to other things, to think of the advantages or disadvantages of it. All of that is done when we're thinking about the object, when the conceptual appearance of the object is what is our appearing object. So the conceptual appearance is not the actual object, but it allows us to think about various qualities and aspects of the object. Memories, thoughts, philosophical views, plans, imaginings, daydreams, and afflictions are all conceptual consciousnesses. Okay, now think about it. Now, when we had a little bit of silent meditation at the beginning of the session, anybody here able to stay on whatever they were meditating on without any distraction? Pretty difficult. What distracted you? When you sit down to meditate, what is the biggest distraction you have? Is it sounds? Is it physical sensations? Your eyes should be lowered, so you shouldn't be looking at other people. If you're looking around and you're distracted like that, that's your problem. Okay, that's not following the instructions properly. Okay, but are you mostly distracted by hearing a sound or a physical touch or a smell or something? Once in a while. Okay. What are most of your distractions in meditation? They're thoughts, aren't they? And daydreams. And emotions. You can spend a whole meditation session thinking about how somebody insulted you 10 years ago. Have you ever done that? Very clear visualization of the person who insulted you 10 years ago. You got every detail of their mind. You can hear the words. I'm not saying your memory is accurate, because we tend to embellish things. So based on the sound we heard, we now think we remember the actual words the person said. Chances are we've embellished it a little bit. Okay? So then we repeat the words back to ourselves that the other person said. We create a story about it. How dare they speak to me that way? It's that they should not speak to me that way. That's completely unacceptable. I don't have that fault. And anyway, nobody should insult me. And then anger arises. Then you remember it some more. You go over it again. You renew your memory of your visualization of exactly what happened. And then your anger gets stronger. Is that person here that you're mad at? Are they speaking to you at that moment and insulting you? What in the world are you getting angry at? Yeah. Or getting angry at something that is not happening right now. We're confusing the conceptual appearance that's appearing to our mind with an actual direct perceiver that happened 10 years ago and that our memory is not exactly 100% on. Because our memory is imputing also a motive on that person. Yeah. When they spoke to us, there's just the sound of their voice. Yeah. Instantly, our mind starts imputing a motivation. Yeah. They want to harm me. Instantly, our mind starts imputing meaning. They're insulting me because they think I'm stupid. They're insulting me because they think they're better than me. Okay? So we impute a meaning to the sound of the words. Then we get very upset. Okay? So the incident happened. It stopped. Our conceptual mind took over. And we're off, you know, remembering that incident for the rest of our lives. Whenever we turn our mind to it, we remember that, embellished, of course, and only seeing one side of it, and we get upset again and again and again and again. Even the other person dies, they no longer exist, we get mad at them. Okay? So while our conceptual consciousness can be used for good things, you know, we're designing the Buddha Hall right now. We're all listening to teachings and thinking about them. That's conception. Thinking about them is the conceptual consciousness. So while we can use our conceptual consciousness for really good things, yeah, when we're not careful, we go off into Never Never Land, you know, in our projections, our imputations, our sensitivities, okay? And none of that is the actual reality of the situation. Okay? So we get mad at a situation that we think actually happen the way our memory is remembering it. But if you ever talked over a past situation with somebody and they remember it entirely differently, we say, you said da 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 da. The other person said, no, I didn't. Yes, you did, I'm sure. No, I didn't. I have people, when I give talks on anger, they'll come up to me afterwards and they'll say, you said that we shouldn't get angry. And I'll say, please listen to the tape. I never say we shouldn't get angry. You listen to the tape and see if I said that. Okay? So somebody heard me talk about the disadvantages of anger. Because we understand the disadvantages, then we want to oppose it and subdue it. But that person didn't hear it as the disadvantages of anger. They heard it as me telling them what to do. You shouldn't get angry. But that's not what I said. Okay? So lots of times, when we're remembering a situation, we're not actually remembering what happened. We're remembering our interpretation of what happened. Okay? And so we get ourselves into a lot of problems like that. And a lot of our emotional reactions come from that, you know? And it's just not going on anywhere. Except in our mind, okay? So that's conceptual consciousnesses used in the wrong way. When we use them in the right way, we think about impermanence, we think about emptiness, we think about how our conceptual consciousnesses aren't always exact. Okay, we learn the Dharma. Okay, so there's a good side to thought and a bad side to it. Okay. Conceptuality covers a wide range from the thought, this is a pot, to the conception grasping inherent existence, to a correct assumption of the meaning of emptiness, to an inferential cognizer of emptiness on the path of preparation that will soon transform into a non-conceptual direct perceiver of emptiness on the path of seeing. So our conceptual consciousnesses, there's such a wide range, okay? So you might, you know, we may start out with, okay, this is a microphone. Yeah, no problem with that conceptual consciousness. It allows us to communicate with people, yeah? Or we can say, you know, I'm sitting here. No big deal. Yeah, there's a person sitting here. But then we say, I am sitting here. Okay, that changes the meaning, doesn't it? It's not any old person sitting here. It's me sitting here. Yeah, and you should realize who I am and treat me in a certain way. Okay, there we have the grasping at true existence. That's an erroneous mind. We're thinking that there's a truly existent person. There isn't. We don't even realize that we're grasping at true existence. We're so caught up in the idea, I am sitting here. Yeah, this is my seat. Don't you come near it. Okay? Whatever trip we get into. Okay? So we go from there to maybe starting to examine that conception, grasping true existence, and we start dissecting it, we start contemplating emptiness, we come to a correct assumption, yeah, where we kind of get that, no, there's not some inherently existent person sitting there. That's a conceptual consciousness. We continue meditating. We may even get an inferential, a correct understanding through inference of emptiness. That's a conceptual consciousness. Okay. And then later on, when we get to the path of seeing, then we can have a direct perceiver of emptiness. Okay. But even the inference is a mind that can be very powerful in subduing our mind, okay? So there's a wide range of what conception includes. Conception does not always include language, okay? We are very used to using language when we think, yeah? But conceptual minds are not always using language, okay? You can see, if you think with our kitties, yeah, one kitty sees, Mudita sees Upeka. There's the direct perceiver of the color and shape of Upeka's fur. And then Mudita has the conceptual consciousness, danger. Yeah, Upeka is dangerous. Upeka's just sitting there. He's not doing anything. Okay. But due to previous experience, she imputes what happened in the past on the present thing. And even though he's just sitting there minding his own business, she gets terrified. And then she either runs away or she hisses at him. Okay. We do the same thing. Yeah, we hiss in different ways, but you know, it's the same kind of thing. Yeah, so you can see, you know, here's an animal, you know, mudita is not thinking, you know, oh, upekkha is dangerous because of this and this and this happened in the past. You know, she's not using words, but there's conceptual consciousness, you know, and there's memory and there's projection of what's going to happen in the future. And all that is her conceptual mind, even though she's an animal without language. Okay? Mother animals know their babies, and babies know their, you know, baby animals know their mother animals. You know, there's no language being used, but they, you know, there's a conceptual mind that is saying, oh, this being is safe, you know, and this being will feed me. And so they go towards, you know, the mama bear or the mama mouse or whatever it is. Okay. Sense consciousnesses directly perceive their objects, while thought apprehends its object in an indirect way by means of negation. Okay, so when we think about yellow, the opposite of non-yellow appears to our mind, and that is the conceptual appearance of yellow. Okay, so I can't really explain this much, but this is the way they philosophically differentiate what is the appearing object to the mind. Yeah, so the object directly appears to a direct perceiver, but the opposite of the non-object is what appears to the conceptual mind, and that's the conceptual appearance. Okay, so it's the negation of everything that isn't the object. So the conceptual appearance comes not because you're directly seeing the object, but somehow there's this thing of everything that's not that object is appearing to the mind, which is, you know, the object's appearing, but because you've gone through that negation process, it's a conceptual appearance. A conceptual consciousness does not know its object directly, but knows it through a negative process. Its appearing object is a conceptual appearance, an image of the object that comes about by negating everything that is not that object. In other words, what appears to a thought that knows a flower is the elimination of everything that is not a flower. This image expresses the general meaning of flower by combining the characteristics of many flowers with different characteristics that sense consciousness has perceived at different times. Okay? So, yeah, when I say flower, yeah, do you have an image in your mind of a flower? Okay, what kind of flower is your image? What? You're seeing a daisy. You're seeing?
Daisy.
What? A daisy? Huh. Oh, okay. Okay. Huh? Okay, you're seeing an Indian paintbrush. What? A rose? Okay. What kind of flower are you seeing? A lotus. Yeah. Okay. So one word, everybody is having a meaning you know, a conceptual appearance of a flower. Yeah. The conceptual appearance, which flower it is different for different people. Okay. But we're all thinking about a flower. So it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, what we did to create this image of flower, because we've all seen, you know, roses and lotuses and daisies and Indian paintbrushes and carnations and, you know, whatever. We've all seen those different flowers. To create the conceptual appearance of flower, we put together similar traits in all these different kinds of flowers. Yeah, and we come up with the flower that we think of, even though it's a different one for every person. But all of the flowers that we're thinking of all have similar traits. Okay, so you can see the conceptual appearance is something that our mind made up. Mm-hmm. And so the flowers that, when we say flower, you know, each of us saw the, you know, different flowers at different times. So we're not even thinking necessarily of one flower we saw at a particular time, but we're all remembering different kinds of flowers and putting together all those different common characteristics and creating a general image of a flower. Okay. So because a conceptual appearance comes about through a process of negation and of elimination and negation, it is generally considered a permanent phenomenon, although the mind to which it appears is impermanent. There is a debate about this, however. So this footnote I will read because we talked to Jeffrey Hopkins a lot about it. And he said that his teacher, Geshe Gendon Lodro, said that from the viewpoint of a conceptual appearance being the opposite of what is not the object, it is permanent, because everything that is a negation, you know, is permanent. However, from the viewpoint of a conceptual appearance being a mental creation, Geshe Gendon Lodro says, it is a functioning thing. For example, when we visualize a meditational deity, the conceptual appearance of the deity has an effect on our mind. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, that explanation makes a lot of sense. Because just saying that the whole thing is permanent, I don't know. I never understood that. So it is a topic of debate, and it probably will be for a long, long time. Okay, so now, next paragraph, we're going to get into the two words, appearing object and apprehended object. So the appearing object to the conception of a flower, okay, so the appearing object is the primary object that appears to that conceptual object, to that conceptual consciousness, is the conceptual appearance of the flower. Okay? So that appearance to your mind of whatever kind of flower you're thinking about, that's the appearing object to your thought consciousness of a flower. The apprehended object of that mind, okay, what that consciousness actually apprehends is the flower. Okay? Because you're not thinking about a pot. You're not thinking about a golf club. You're thinking about a flower. So the apprehended object is the flower, but how the appearing object of that consciousness is the conceptual appearance of the flower. Okay. Conflating the actual flower with the appearance of the flower to a conceptual consciousness enables us to think about the flower. Okay. So somehow, you know, we conflate them, we mix them up, and then we can think about the flower. Oh, yes, you know, I'm thinking of the flower in my room right now, and it's beginning to wilt. I need to water it. Okay? So like that. Okay, conceptual consciousnesses are useful, because through them, we understand the broader properties and potentials of things and the relationships among them. Okay, so when we're going to the architect to talk about the Buddha Hall, yeah, so we're all talking about the Buddha Hall. Like, okay, how big is the room? And we develop an idea of how big the room is, and how big, how tall are the walls? And, oh, it feels too much like a box. And we imagine being in a box with no natural light. And we say, no, we don't like that. Then we imagine, cutting out part of a section so that there's natural light coming in. And we imagine in our mind being in a Buddha hall where there's some natural light. Oh, that feels much better. Then, we think of the ceiling. Instead of the ceiling just going straight up with clear story windows in the top, we think of the ceiling also coming up like this, And there's dormers, and so there's shape to the ceiling, and there's more natural light coming in. And so we're imagining all of this, and then the architect draws it, So sometimes he draws a side view of it, sometimes he draws a bird's eye view, a floor plan of the hall. All of this is conceptual consciousness. That whole designing project, from imagining what it's like to taking out some elements, putting in other elements, all of that is what thought allows us to do. Okay? Same thing when we're thinking about the kind of Buddha image that we want to have. Yeah? So do we want to have a Buddha that is made of bronze, which gives a different feeling, or a Buddha made of some kind of polyurethane something, which is going to have a different feeling to it. Do we want the Buddha's robes to be painted on the statue, or do we want to actually have cloth for the Buddha's robes? Okay, so all of thinking. The Buddha statue, there's nothing to look at right now. Yeah. But all of the imagination of what we're going to create, that's all conceptual consciousnesses. And we are able to think like that because we've had direct perceivers of different Buddha statues in the past. And we've seen, Buddha statues made of bronze with an actual robe. We've seen Buddha statues made of polyurethane with painted robes. We've seen Buddha statues made of wood, Buddha statues made of stone, So all those different things that we're remembering, conceptual consciousness is remembering those. Now we're taking different details from different Buddha statues and putting them together to form a mental image of the kind of statue we want to have. Okay. It's tied back to direct perception. But that whole process of designing is conceptual consciousness. And only our mental consciousness is conceptual. Sense consciousnesses are never conceptual. So this is something in the break time between sessions. Yeah. Take walks and relax your mind. And as you walk around, observe, what is direct perceiving? Yeah. And what is my thinking about the object? And how are my thoughts about what I'm seeing influenced by my past experience? So how much am I having a thought consciousness that is memory influencing the thought consciousness I'm having now about the object? Okay, I'll give you an example. Right now, when I look over your heads in the back of the room out of the window, I'm seeing the tamarack trees that are turning yellow. Okay? So I see the tamarack trees, I see the yellow. Then my mind is remembering tamarack trees, what they looked like a few weeks ago before some of the needles had fallen off, when the color yellow was much brighter. And I'm looking and saying, oh, those tamarack trees don't look so good, you know? The needles have fallen off, the yellow is kind of pale, you know, that one looks really, most of the needles are gone. Is that one actually a tamarack tree or not? I can't see so well. Okay, but instantly I start comparing to the tamarack trees that I saw a few weeks ago that were so gorgeous because they were such a bright yellow and had all the needles on them. Yeah. So walk around, take a walk, and watch what's going on in your mind. Yeah, and how much are you seeing directly, and how much is your mind starting to compare it with what you've seen in the past, generate assumptions about it, have opinions, likes, and dislikes about it. Okay, when it comes time to eating lunch, okay, so you have some homework to do, and you know, when we're studying this, when it comes time to eating lunch, yeah, look at your food, yeah, whatever. I don't know what are we having today?
Spaghetti.
Spaghetti. Okay. So, Venerable Losung spaghetti. Okay. So, which is different than Venerable Yeshi's spaghetti. Yeah. Which, and Venerable Sultram's spaghetti. Okay. So, So, look at the spaghetti, and then think of how you think. Imagine how you think that spaghetti is going to taste. And then put some in your mind, in your mouth, and see if it tastes like you thought it was going to taste. Okay, there will probably be salad or some vegetable. You know, look at it and see, you know, because whenever we look at food, we imagine what it's going to taste like. So be aware of what you think it's going to taste like. And then taste it and see if what you imagined is what is actually there, what the actual taste is. Okay? And how much your assumption of what is going to taste like is coming from past experience. So this is very, very interesting. Yeah. Salad, you know, isn't such a big deal. Look at the desserts, you know, because most salad is kind of standard, but it does fluctuate. The desserts, you know, you can really see. You look at something and you imagine, oh, wow, that's going to taste like this. Oh, I really like that. And then you taste it and it's like, who made this? Yeah. They expect me to eat this. It usually doesn't happen as the reverse, because if we look at it and have an image of what it's going to taste like that we don't like, then we usually don't even try it. So we usually don't have the reverse of tasting it and, oh, this tastes so much better than I thought. At least for the desserts, at least for me, you know. Maybe for you it's different. You'll eat anything that's a dessert. I'm very picky about desserts, you know. I figure if I'm going to eat calories, it's got to be something I really like, not just something that they call a dessert. It's got to be a real dessert that is sweet, yeah. Okay, so this is how this teaching is very practical to our lives, yeah. We've got to look at this kind of stuff. Okay. Conceptual consciousnesses enable us to learn about things that we cannot directly, that we cannot perceive directly through sense perceivers. Scientific theories, planning a benefit event to help a charity, and considering measures that will stop global warming all depend on our ability to conceptualize objects, conceptualize their causes, conceptualize their results, the relationships, their abilities, and so forth. Okay. In fact, most of our education entails learning terms and concepts. Yeah. Some of our education is seeing things that we haven't seen before. Most of our education is conceptual, learning the properties, relationships, causes, and effects of different objects. Yeah. I think that's why after I graduated from college, I wanted to go travel because I wanted to have experiences and not just read a book about something. Yeah. Reading a book is very different than having an actual experience. Okay, so we have some time for Q and maybe A.
So earlier you were talking about how sense consciousnesses perceive things directly, and then conceptual consciousnesses create this image based on the raw data. So it made me wonder, do we ever see the objects that we perceive, are those just concepts? Because, for example, the book, mm-hmm. we can only see visually the color of the shape.
Yeah.
But that's not the book.
Yeah.
So then our mental consciousness must generate this object called book based on that raw data. Yeah. Is that the case?
Okay. So this is one of the points of debate, you know, that came up in and has come up repeatedly in our discussions with Jeffrey. Yeah. Because in the last session, he was saying that due to familiarity with that color and shape, then we see the book. He was saying the eye consciousness knows the book. Now, definitely at the beginning, when we're just little kids and we're learning to call things by names, we're seeing the color and shape, and then we learn, oh, this sense data fits together, and it's an actual discrete object, and we give it a name. So at that point, it's very clear what is a sense-direct perception and what is a conceptual one. Then he's saying that by familiarity, the eye consciousness just knows it's a book. That I don't really know, you know. I'm not sure that everybody says that. It could be that, you know, just very quickly the identification comes, oh, book. Yeah, so I can't really answer that question. When I just look at the way things are described, it seems to me that it would have to be the mental consciousness that knows that it's a book. But we have what Jeffrey said, where he said, no, the visual consciousness can know it.
The book itself, how it exists, is it only just a concept in our minds?
No, it's a book. It's a book. Yeah, but it's not an inherently existent book. It exists by being designated. Okay? So it exists independence, yeah, on the mind. It doesn't exist out there as an objective object. But on a conventional level, it is a book. Okay, we can't call it a giraffe. Well, you can, but, you know, okay, you're going to have some problems.
It's just very profound.
It is.
To think about.
That. Yeah, very profound. Because the thing is, we look at this sense data and we say book, and then we forget that we're the ones who called it a book. And instead, we think that there's something inside this thing that is radiating, I'm a book, I'm a book, I'm a book. Yeah. And then we think that the book is some objective thing out there, completely independent of our mind or independent of anybody's mind. And it's not.
It just seems that there are a couple of uses of this word clearly, like on the first page.
Yeah.
Because the definition of consciousness is clear and knowing, or clarity and awareness,
yeah,
or cognition. And that includes every consciousness. But
yeah,
here it's specifically talking about...
about it being a clear appearance
without
to a non-conceptual mind. There, clear means direct. Yeah. It's like there's many words in Buddhism. The word is the same, but the meaning is different depending on the context of it. Yeah, this happens a lot. And in English, we do well recognizing that one word has different meanings in different situations because we're very familiar with those words, yeah? But, you know, when we're learning something new, then it's like, wait, I just want one word and one meaning, yeah? Don't make it mean different things in different situations. Yeah, because we're not familiar with that, so we can't pick out the different meanings. But in English, you know, I mean, the word clear can mean many different things, can't it? You know, the glass is clear, somebody's explanation is clear, but the explanation and the glass, the clarity is very different in the two. But we understand the difference in the meaning because we're quite familiar with it. Yeah.
Clear. When we're meditating on the clear appearance, we're not in any way inferring that we're seeking a direct perception. Are we or are we?
No. When we're having a clear appearance, there, clear means kind of, that you can have all the details of the object. Yeah. Yeah, but no, the clear appearance means that it's appearing clearly to you without fuzzy details. Yeah.
So we know that a yogic direct perceiver of emptiness happens at the path of seeing.
Mm-hmm.
The power of clairvoyance, can that happen earlier?
Yeah, it can happen earlier.
Could it happen even at the path of accumulation?
Yeah, it can even, somebody can... even gain that without entering a path.
Okay. And then for some people who have this gift, it just is a leftover from a previous life.
It can be cases. A karmic thing. It doesn't mean that power is always accurate.
Right.
Yeah. So don't always trust the fortune tellers.
And don't trust what we think someone is thinking about us.
Oh, definitely. What I think, you think, I think. Yeah.
You were talking about visualization being conceptual. I was wondering about the experienced meditator who sees bones everywhere.
Yeah, that's one that they call an object to a mental consciousness. And it's not actual bones that they perceive. But they also say that it's not really a conceptual consciousness either, because that it starts out as a conceptual consciousness because you're visualizing bones everywhere. But when somebody actually has samadhi on it, you know, and somehow I don't understand 100% how that exactly works. Okay. But it's different than seeing it directly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around an appearing object that it has to negate everything that is not the object.
And that's for a conceptual consciousness.
A conceptual consciousness. An image of an object that comes about by negating. So for me to look at, to imagine you, I have to negate everything in this room in a nanosecond to get that image to my mind.
Yes, and that's why I said I couldn't explain it any
deeper,
any further.
Okay.
That somehow that process of negation is happening very quickly and very automatically.
And that, because it seems like memory would simply just call up the object as a conceptual appearance. I wouldn't have to do anything more than that. So it's
It's happening very quickly. And I don't think you're thinking, okay, what is right. everything, you know, everything that is not that log is then the opposite of that, oh yeah, the log now, oh yeah, now I have a log appearing to my, you know, that's not going on.
But what this does have me understand is the potential and the capacity of the mind to create its experience.
Yes.
And how that mind can be used to perceive something unfathomable as emptiness because of its capacity to do something this simple as eliminating everything in the room to get an image in the mind. So it's not like I'm questioning. It's just look at the power of the mind to be able to do that so we understand what we're looking at inside of our mind's eye.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the mind is incredible, and we don't even understand a small portion of it.
It occurs to me in this discussion that the conceptual consciousness is not always reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reminded of the example of a person walking down a path who sees something on the path. Oh, my goodness, it's a snake. I'm running in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
No, it's actually a piece of rope, kind of, you know, an S shape on the path. Could you comment on that? How reliable actually is this conceptual consciousness? It seems to me it's shaded enormously by our personal experience and our cultural experience as well.
Anger, you know, the angry mind is totally unreliable. The mind of attachment also, you know, these are erroneous consciousnesses. And our minds don't even realize that they're erroneous.
Well, I'm reminded of seeing someone in a context where I don't normally see them and simply not even recognizing them.
Yes.
So I think we must do a lot of screening already with whatever context of the situation is and say, well, these are impossibilities.
Right.
Maybe not, you know, forefront of the mind, but, you know, we're simplifying.
Right. And in any situation, you know, even with the direct perceivers, like many things may be appearing to our mind, but what we actually ascertain is limited. Yeah. And Venerable Jhampa circulated this very cute experiment that somebody did with players, some wearing white and some wearing black, and they were passing the ball to each other. And your job was to count how many times people wearing white passed the ball. So when you're focused on that, what many people don't see is there's somebody in a gorilla suit, black gorilla suits, that walks right through this whole moving group of people passing two balls, the people in black are passing balls, the people in white are passing. This gorilla walks right through. Yeah, they're there for several seconds. And many people, when I did it, I saw something, but it didn't register because I was focusing on the people in the white shirts passing the ball, and I didn't even see the gorilla walk through. Yeah. And it was right there in front of my eyes. So lots of times, you know, there's a whole group of there's one kind of consciousness where things appear, but we don't ascertain them. Yeah? It's like, you know, you talk with, you know, we're talking with the architect, and then afterwards, we go over some of the things, and then Venerable Tarpa will say, oh, well, he said da-da-da-da-da. And I said, no, he didn't. I didn't hear that. So now is it her mind that is interpreting something he did say and adding something in, or my mind that he said that and I never ascertained it? So we can fight about it. this is what a lot of fights are about, really. Yeah? Okay. Did you have a question, Catherine? No, it was you. Okay.
This goes back to the negating.
Uh-huh.
So something my small son asked me about when he was really little, and I've pondered it now, and it's coming up today, is he said, Mom, why is it when we give something a name, and he was looking at a tree when he was saying this, we put a barricade around it?
Oh, wow. Whoa.
He was about six at the time.
Oh,
and
my
it totally
goodness.
Stumped me.
Yeah.
And so now that... Yeah.
Smart kid. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's close for this morning.